Okay, I'm going to talk about Iran and not just the repercussions of the energy side of this, but long-term political fallout, geopolitical ramifications. But I want to speak a little bit more about this. What I was talking about, the Comanches and Apaches in Texas in the 1870s. And in this book, there's just like hundreds of, you know, 2, 3, 10-page accounts printed in newspapers or diaries. And probably the best book I've read on it is this Herman Lehman, 9 Years Among the Indians, 1870 to 1879. Basically his teenage years, growing to manhood. And the reason I want to talk about that is if we're coming into really hard times, the mental preparation is going to be so much more important than, you know, how much money do you have? How many cases of MREs have you stacked? That's important, believe me. But the mental side of this is unbelievably important because we've grown so soft. I think millions of people will die from despair because they just won't understand when the supermarkets are looted and the water stops coming out of the faucet. They won't know what to do. They literally won't be able to function. They'll have no idea how to survive. And a lot of the worst people will be the primary survivors because they've at least suffered some in their life and are more used to hardship, including refugees and others that have come to America from war zones or, you know, very poor third world countries. They'll actually do better than Americans that have never lived without AC. You know, that addiction specialists, I've read this and known this for years, and it's really very counterintuitive. They'll talk about heroin. It's hard to kick heroin or hard to kick the morphine related narcotics, but they say there's actually no pain in withdrawal. It's not that there's pain from withdrawal. You're so used to living in a pleasure zone. You're so used to living in a zone that without that, you can't stand it. You can't stand life in the normal, no pleasure buzz zone that you're going crazy to get back into that zone. It's not that there's pain from withdrawal. People interpret DTs, going cold turkey, as painful. No, they're just trying to get back to the zone. Well, our civilization, we've been living in the zone. You know, we have a thermostat on the wall, and it's like, well, I want it at 76, and my wife wants it at 78, and we're always arguing, no, 81 is just too hot. Or you know, 74, what, are you trying to freeze us to death and run up our electric bill? This was never even an issue for 99.9% of human history. The temperature was the temperature. Think about before the 20th century, there wasn't even an electric fan. If you wanted it colder, you better go up a mountain or wait for winter. That was it. Those were your choices. If you were rich, have a slave fan you. That's it. You know, it didn't matter if you were the king of England or the czar of Russia. There was no air conditioning. There was no refrigeration. The temperature was the temperature. In the winter, you built a fire. In the summer, you did the best you could. Imagine living in Texas or Arizona, you know, 150 years ago. Nobody ever heard of electricity. Nobody ever dreamed about air conditioning or running water. That was just their baseline was so much more hardcore. You know, he wrote this later, but Herman Lehman, he's kidnapped when he's like, you know, 11 or 12, going up until like, you know, age 19 with the Indians. These guys would be chased by Texas Rangers. They didn't fear the soldiers. The soldiers were a joke, but they feared the Texas Rangers. And that's what a book that is. Every American boy should read this book. And it's not just to say how terrible the Apaches and Comanches were or what great raiders and warriors they were, which they were, or how cruel they were, which they were. It's how much tougher people were. You know, these settlers in Texas, mostly German at the time, Fredericksburg, Carroll County, these guys had an expectation of a hard life. Then they're kidnapped by Indians and their life becomes 10 times harder. But they didn't go into shock and cry and go into the corner sucking their thumb or say, just kill me. They adapted. These guys would, you know, unlike every cowboy movie you ever saw, where the cowboys are like making a campfire and sleeping around the campfire, the Comanches and Apaches on the run would never build a fire. They knew that the Texas Rangers were going to sleep in the saddle. They had to ride for days straight, sleeping in the saddle, tie themselves to the horse. You know, the person awake is guided, leading the other horses. If they had to eat, if they killed one of their own mules, they would take its stomach contents and eat the stomach contents cold. They would, any game that they ate, they were ready to eat cold on the spot. They couldn't take the time to make a fire. And if you made a fire, it would be a giveaway. If you had to make a fire, you'd dig a hole like 3 feet down and make a coal fire way down at night with wood that wouldn't make smoke. Because if you made smoke or any light, you'd be done. That would be it. Yeah, this is this war between the Texas Rangers and the Apaches and Comanches was that serious. These guys on the run crossing deserts, if they found a spring that was dried up, they would eat mud. They'd eat mud because in the mud was some moisture. Yeah, they would eat bugs. They would eat anything that they could find. Insects, lizards, frogs, they would eat them. I'm not saying like, oh, wow, that's so gross. Why are you telling me this? I'm saying that they started with a much more tough baseline. No air conditioning, no central heat, right? You know, it's miles to visit anybody by horse. Kids had to learn to saddle horses and do all the horse work as like practically toddlers. And by the time you're 10 or 11, you better be doing work. Or you take it to the Indians and it's next level. I mean, there was absolutely none of this like, oh, you just want to be a squaw, or you can go with the girls. No. All of the Indian boys were tested, including the white captives. They had to fight each other. They had to like, you know, do boxing matches, wrestling matches constantly, you know, with the rest of the tribe looking on and laughing. And if you weren't at least trying as hard as you could to fight, they had no use for you. You'd be done. They'd leave you. This is how they raised that warrior culture, that warrior ethos. You only were with your mother while you were on the breast and a toddler. After that, you were with the men. And if you can't handle hanging with the men, we have no use for you. Why am I saying all this? If we're going into these hard times, your mind is going to have to become hard very fast. If it's not, then you're going to go into a shock from suddenly no air conditioning. Oh my God, I'm in Phoenix. I'm in Texas. It's 105 outside and there's no power. What am I going to do? Well, what did your great-grandfather do? He never heard of air conditioning. He didn't surrender. But so much is going to happen so fast. He grew up in that era. He had no expectation. We have an expectation of running water, a supermarket full of food that we can afford. We have that expectation. They were tougher because they grew up without that expectation. They never thought of a fan, much less air conditioning. So when all of this happens, when there are famines in the world, and America will maybe not go into famine like some African country, but our social network is going to fracture and collapse because we have, you know, 350 million people, 100 million of them are fed by the government, some kind of EBT, some kind of food stamp program. When all of this stops, they're going to feel that the social contract has been broken. That rich guy with the garage that's all full of stored food, they're going to know about this, even to the point of you have lights on. That means you have electricity. How do you have electricity? A generator, solar panels? You're going to have to hide things like this. And eventually, it will get down to the point of everybody around you that you encounter is looking like Auschwitz, you know, is looking like Bataan Death March. And you've still got some food on your face. You know, you're not You're not looking like, you know, your bones aren't sticking out. How's that happening? You know, when people get to that level, and already, you know, the cities are exploding and people are looking for new places to loot, you're going to have to be very smart about this. Don't worry about refrigeration. Don't worry about air conditioning. They're not going to happen. You know, if the rest of the world in the period of an American social collapse, because we'll have the money, we'll have more food than many countries, but we'll probably go through a social fracture and collapse sooner than a lot of countries because of the baked in social problems that we have. There are countries that are much more poor than us that you would say, well, won't they go into collapse sooner? Maybe not, because psychologically they're already tougher. If you grow up in a South American country where electricity is only a 50-50 proposition anyway, you know, that where in your living memory you've had currency collapses, you've had hyperinflation. You know what happens when the supermarkets are empty, and you're prepared to deal with that psychologically. I don't think Americans are prepared to deal with it psychologically. So I think it's going to hit here a lot worse. And that's why, you know, and I don't mean to, you know, talk about how cruel the Comanches and Apaches were, and they were, but you know, when you read this, and I would give this to every young boy in America, 9 years among the Indians, say, look, he didn't quit. He was suddenly thrust into a situation where he was with other Indian boys his age, and they were tough. And he had to gain their respect. It was either that or just surrender and die. And he wasn't going to surrender and die. He became a Comanche. You know, he became an Apache, both, because he was sold from one to the other. Sometimes they formed up in common cause against the white settlers. But I think that as soft as we are, it's going to be a much bigger drop. It's going to be a really difficult psychological fracture if we get to the point where a lot of supermarkets have been looted, the people in the urban areas are going out to the suburbs foraging, not enough police to keep the peace, you know, then what happens? Anyway, enough on that. So when Trump was over in Beijing, Chairman Xi actually, you know, mentioned that America is a declining power. You know, the Thucydides trap came up, where a declining power, a declining empire, you know, is lashing out and trying to maintain its dominance. So I forget who said this. It might have been Dugin, the Russian, that the Russians and the Chinese see their situation now as managing the American decline from a unipolar world to a multipolar world without America lashing out and taking the whole world down with it in a massive, you know, Thucydides trap reaction. How do we, it's like having a belligerent drunk relative, you know, and you've got to walk him out of the bar. He's threatening everybody. He's got guns and knives all over the place, but he's your brother, and you're trying to walk him out to the truck, maybe get him to sleep it off. You don't want him to lash out, go nuts, and you all wind up in jail or dead in a, you know, huge brawl. So that's where Russia and China are today. How do we get America to go from believing that we like dominate the globe? Whatever we want, we get. We got the aircraft carriers, we got the bombers, you know, we've got the 82nd Airborne and all of the, you know, and we can just do whatever we want, wherever we want. That's obviously coming to an end. And I think that even in the Pentagon, behind the scenes, that message is being conveyed to Trump and the cabinet. You'll see in the New York Times and Atlantic and other places where it seems like even the intelligence services are saying, we can't do another round of attacks on Iran. Number one, we're almost out of our standoff weapons. Why does that matter? Well, when Alex has mentioned, you know, we dropped 3 million tons of bombs on Vietnam, that's when we could just fly over Vietnam with B-52s in formation. They would literally fly from Guam to Thailand dropping bombs over Vietnam, load up more bombs in Thailand, drop more bombs on Vietnam, and fly back to Guam, okay? So what's that got to do with anything? We could just fly over Vietnam dropping iron bombs. You'd see the, like, World War II just coming down, carpet bombing, one crater linked to the next crater, sideways, lengthwise. And what we were trying to do was cut off Vietnam from resupply from China. The Ho Chi Minh Trail ran parallel to North and South Vietnam through Laos and Cambodia. And we spent, you know, 8 years carpet bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and we never cut them off. So now we're trying to force Iran to submit because we're blockading their oil exports, as if that's going to make them submit. But Iran is 10 times bigger than South Vietnam, with 6 times its population. We had unlimited B-52 just vertically dropping iron bombs. They didn't surrender. Now, we can't even fly over Iran. If we do, we're taking a chance on being shot down. So we have to launch these JASSM missiles, it's like a cruise missile launched from a jet, because we don't want to fly right over Iran. So we're launching, you know, missiles that cost $2 or $3 million each that we have a limited number of. So we're this isn't going to happen. I don't think we're going to go back to a big air attack. If it is, it's going to be some symbolic thing that Trump will wrap into a walkaway scenario. We destroyed their Navy. We destroyed their Air Force. So we won. But Iran's not going to let us off that easy, because they don't want us just coming back in another 6 months or a year. So they're going to maintain control of the Strait of Hormuz. They know that we can't physically retake it from them. If we could have physically retaken it from them, we would have done it already. What that Project Freedom was about was an attempt to escort ships out of the Persian Gulf. There are thousands of them stuck in there, including, I think, 3 more American merchant ships stuck in the Persian Gulf 81 days. And they were going to escort them through the southern Omani Channel, which some people had said we had cleared of mines with anti-mine drones, meaning we can't actually put a boat there to search for drones that way. So from some distance away, we're going to hypothetically clear that southern Omani Channel. So we sent 2 of our best destroyers, Burke-class destroyers, DDGs, guided missile destroyers, briefly into the Persian Gulf for 2 or 3 days. It's still very sketchy. There's no geolocations, but the best take is that 2 of the Burke classes went into the Persian Gulf, where they have a very limited range, because depending on their speed, they've only got between like 3 and 10 days of fuel. If they run out of fuel in the Persian Gulf, they're dead in the water. They could be captured, sunk, anything. So part of this Project Freedom was, we'll send destroyers in and escort ships out. I think we got 2 American ships out. A French ship tried to follow and was hit. Our DDGs had to flee that Oman channel at the bottom, had to flee back out to sea. So we can't open the Persian Gulf. Doesn't matter if they have no Air Force or Navy. They have geography. They have you know, 1,000 miles of coastline to fire drones and missiles at our ships. So we're not just in a stalemate where we can do this forever, because meanwhile, the world economy is going straight downhill. And every week that goes by, the world reserve, that tank bottom, is getting closer and closer. And it's not solved by ships coming to Texas and Louisiana and filling up. That doesn't solve it. That drives our prices up, makes the rest of the world hate our guts, and it's still sucking that big tank, the global tank, is still sucking down, because we're missing that, you know, 15 or 20 million barrels per day. It's taken out. You know, one of the downfalls of this modern, interconnected, just-in-time economy, it's great when you consider that tankers are like little beads of little strands of beads crossing the ocean, going to every country. You know, a week apart, there's a tanker heading to Holland, to Australia, to Taiwan, Japan, Korea. And, you know, it may be every 3 days for this country, every week for that country. But their national tank, fuel tank, gas and oil, is somewhere in the 80 to 40%. Here comes the ship. It's back up to 70%. Those ships have sailed. They're done. So it's back to that tsunami situation. We don't feel it yet because we haven't hit tank bottom yet. And other countries will hit tank bottom before America. That's true. So we're going to see this around the world, like what we saw a glimpse of in Sri Lanka a couple years ago. They made some bad political decisions. They went tank bottom and had, you know, social explosion all over Sri Lanka. Out of fuel. That means everything closes. Well, they're getting there in places like, you know, like Vietnam and Korea and Japan. They're getting there. And it's not something like Trump is saying, don't worry, as soon as we straighten up the Strait of Hormuz situation, the oil prices will fall. That's delusional thinking. If it stopped tomorrow, if the tankers left the Gulf today, it's still going to be, depending on how far, you know, 40, 45, 50 days before those tankers can get to the next, to the countries to offload, to save them from tank bottom. If we hit tank bottom, it's going to be global repercussions. It already will be, especially when you consider that there are countries that just aren't planting because they have no fertilizer. They have no experience with how do we go back to 19th century agriculture? Well, we didn't have 8 billion people in the 19th century. You know, the food meaning of the globe of the Green Revolution was we can get 3 or 4 times the harvest out of an acre, you know, with modern diesel-run combine harvesters, with modern seeds, with modern fertilizers, pesticides, the whole thing, fuel-running irrigation pumps, everything. We can now feed 8 billion people. You take away the diesel, no fuel, no water irrigation pumps, no diesel tractor harvesters, no fertilizer. So we may be seeing in 2027 the effect of what's happening in 2026, because we're still eating the 2025 harvest. The 2027 harvest should be going in now, but in a lot of the world, it's not going in. So no matter what happens, this is going to have global consequences, you know, cascading global consequences. Anyway, well, I'm glad to be able to talk to you, and I don't know the next time I'll see you, but hopefully pretty soon with better news, something, maybe the Trump will do the walk away and not the bombs away. If we do the bombs away, we're just digging a deeper hole. And yeah, the morons that say, yeah, Matt, they'll have to come to Texas and Louisiana for even more of the last fuel in the world. Yeah, and they'll hate us. And they'll be out for revenge forever against us if countries go into famine. You know, usually famines were something that, you know, related to a drought or maybe a regional war. China and Japan suffered famines over and over again. This famine, this global famine, will have one very well-known cause, and it'll be February 28th, what Trump did then. So anyway, I'll talk to you later. And hopefully better news next time. You know, I've got, I'm plugging other guys' books today. This isn't even other guys' books. This is just history. And I think that it will work for you in order to just psychologically toughen you. And maybe, you know, your kids. Have your boys read these books. And, you know, I've got my own books too. You know, all of these I've been writing for years. But anyway, I'll talk to you next time. See you later.
Then at midnight.